This is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us today. We're looking at ways to enjoy your garden year-round through freezing, pickling, fermenting, and many other preserving methods. Back with us is Scott Wilson, better known as YouTube's Gardener Scott. He's been preserving his harvest for a while now, and he's going to share his expertise with us. What questions do you have preserving? Or other gardening questions, of course, he can answer those too. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Hi, Scott. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Jill. How are you today?
I am great. The weather here is amazing. How's it in Colorado?
It is too hot.
Oh, dear. Yeah,
I know it's crazy to complain about the heat,
but right.
when we're expecting fall and we're still getting summer, my plants are still suffering.
Oh, gosh, that is terrible. You know, I have a friend who was actually hiking last week in Colorado, and she said it was super hot, too. So, yeah, that is it throws you off, doesn't it?
It really does, because we're talking about the preserving today, and that's
right.
The mode I'm beginning to get into. But my plants don't yet know that because it's not cooling off enough for them to get into that full harvest mode.
Right. Well, it'll come eventually, but it's really going to all come at the same time, isn't it?
Yeah, it tends to be that way.
It does tend to be that way. So that's one of these reasons why I wanted to talk about what to do when you get all of those fruit and veg at the same time. Now, how did you learn about all these methods that we wanted to talk about today?
So a little over 20 years ago, I became a Colorado Master Gardener through the Extension Service and spent a lot of time volunteering and got to know the nutrition advisor very well and realized that preservation and gardening go hand in hand. So I actually became a master food preserver through the Extension Service and began teaching classes on everything you mentioned to start this segment, the freezing, the dehydrating, the fermenting, all of those things I've actually taught classes on for the Extension Service.
Well, I happened to watch your video that you put out on YouTube about that, and I'm like, oh my gosh, this guy is like a book. He answered every question he knows. So I was duly impressed, sir.
Well, thank you.
So first off, how do you select the vegetables to do these procedures with? Because sometimes you can get, you know, one that's maybe well beyond or it's not quite ready. I mean, how do you select the vegetable or fruit to preserve?
So the point that you would eat the vegetable or fruit is ideally the same point that you would preserve it.
Okay.
And a lot of people go too far. You know, they think that I'm going to pick it, I'm going to put it on the counter. It sits on the counter for a few days or a week, and then they think, oh, it's probably time to preserve it because I've harvested too much. But you really do want to preserve right at that peak of flavor. And even if it's a flavor that's not fully ripe, you know, green tomatoes, for instance, a lot of people will use green tomatoes in different recipes. If that's the point that you like tomatoes, then that's the point you should consider preserving them.
That makes total sense. Thank you. Well, before we get into some of the different types, we have Michelle in Sun Prairie who has a question for you about preserving. Go right ahead, Michelle.
Hello. Thanks for having me. I, like many of us right now, have an abundance of cherry tomatoes, and I'm trying to think of some unique ways to preserve it. Have you ever done sun-dried tomatoes, and can I do that with my cherry tomatoes? Because I love making, sun-dried tomato with chicken. So is there a way that you would recommend that I can make sun-dried tomatoes out of my cherry tomatoes?
Yes, absolutely, Michelle. In fact, that is one of the things I like to preserve because I grow so many cherry tomatoes. And you have to be careful about actual sun drying because of insects and spores that are blowing through the air. So a better method is just to cut the cherry tomato in half and then to put it into a dehydrator or a very low oven overnight. And then it becomes just a bite-sized treat with all that wonderful cherry tomato flavor. And I happen to have a freeze dryer now because I do so much preserving. And that actually has become my favorite way to preserve cherry tomatoes because they are crunchy when you when you put them through a freeze dryer, and that just is such a wonderful flavor. But a basic dehydrator is also basically getting the equivalent of a sun-dried tomato.
Yeah, I love sun-dried tomatoes. Now, how do you preserve those after you dry them? Because, I mean, you can buy them, but they're usually in, like, oil.
Yeah. And so, at least in my house, most of them get eaten before I have to worry too much about. But the key whenever you dry is to keep it dry. And so that may mean putting it in the freezer so that it stays, because the freezer, in most cases, is pretty dry after you completely wrap it. You can also vacuum pack it, or you can just make sure you're putting it in like a pantry or a closet in like a glass jar so it maintains the dryness.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, hopefully that gives you an idea there, Michelle, that you can use some of those cherry tomatoes. Because once you dry them, they take up a lot less space. So go to it. We had Lindsay email to say that she has a large quantity of big and small tomatoes and is looking for interesting ways to use them up. So far, she's made pizza sauce, roasted tomato soup, and pico de gallo salsa. Any other ideas for fresh use or ways to preserve Lindsay's tomatoes?
Yes, that's actually a good way. So depending on the type of tomatoes, so paste tomatoes make a better sauce or a better paste, like a San Marzano or an Italian heirloom type of tomato. So I wouldn't necessarily like to make a sauce out of like a brandy wine or a black cream or something that has a lot of juice. You really do need that fleshiness in it. And so for those tomatoes in general, back to the dehydrator, a couple years ago I discovered tomato powder. And so what you do is you freeze dry or you dehydrate your tomatoes, and then after they're dry, you put them in a spice grinder, and now you've got the taste of tomato that you can sprinkle on your eggs, you can sprinkle on your potatoes, or any other that you would want to use the fresh tomato for. That powder now gives you that flavor of fresh tomatoes.
That sounds so delicious. I can imagine it on pretty much everything.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. And you know, it like making a bruschetta where you would take some French bread with olive oil. Mm. If you don't have the fresh tomatoes, you just sprinkle that tomato powder on it, along with garlic powder. I powder a lot of my garlic as well for that purpose, to like just sprinkle it on toast.
Yeah, when I heard you talk about that, I'm like, why can't we buy that in the store? Not that it would be even half as good as, you know, making your own, but like even on popcorn. Wow, that would be terrific. That would be terrific. So we have a question that's outside of the preserving, but we don't want Rich to wait too long. So Rich in La Crescent, go right ahead with your question, please.
This has to do with cantaloupes. We have these beautiful cantaloupes, fully fleshed out, absolute no flavor. I'm blaming it on this powdery mildew because all the plants and leaves turn white. And when I checked up on it, it's that could be the culprit. My question is, I mulch these plants with grass clippings. Could that be the source of this powdery mildew problem?
So the thing about powdery mildew is that it's everywhere. The spores, it's a fungal disease, and the spores are blowing through the air. And so, yes, it could be the grass, but it's more likely your neighbor's tree or a car driving by that just whips up the air, because the spores are all over the ground. They're all over the trees and plants around us. And so to try to isolate any plant, particularly a melon like cantaloupe, is extremely difficult. So you could try covering the plant in the future, and that may reduce the powdery mildew. But what I typically do is, as soon as I see any sign of powdery mildew, is prune off those leaves as soon as possible. You can use a fungicide to try to deal with it early on. And there's a home remedy that actually some studies have shown actually works, which is to use diluted milk on the leaves. But it's going to happen every year. Powdery mildew is just one of those things about gardening.
And does it affect the taste of his cantaloupe?
It can. And okay. So one thing about, depending on when the grass mulch was placed, so water can affect it, like too much or too little water can affect the flavor. And so grass, if you use fresh green grass clippings, it can actually form a mat and the water doesn't percolate into the soil as well. So that could be a factor. I use dried grass clippings to try to reduce that. Heat, a lot of us have been exposed to heat, and heat can affect the flavor. And then, yes, if everything's going okay, powdery mildew can affect the flavor. But if you put all of those factors together, like many of us have had this year with some drier conditions, some hotter conditions, and powdery mildew, the plant's going to be okay. The fruit's going to be there, but it might not have that sweet flavor that you want.
Okay, great. Thanks for that question. Our guest today is Scott Wilson, better known as YouTube's Gardener Scott. What questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Don in Bayfield County, you're up next. Go right ahead.
Hey, Scott, Don here. Say, you're talking about preserving food with all these present-day conveniences. How did people preserve food 400, 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago?
That is a good question, Don. And that actually brings us to my favorite method of preservation, which is fermenting. And so salt has been used for millennia with our food to either dry it or to make a brine that ferments the food that we're trying to preserve. And so the lactobacillus bacteria is also all around us, and it lives in environments that are salty and low pH based on the lactic acid that they create. And so you have cultures with kimchi and sauerkraut. That is all fermentation, and there are a number of different ways that you can take vegetables and take fruits and preserve them, either with a salt brine or with the fermentation. I love fermenting almost everything in my garden. And then, of course, we talked about the dehydrator, but you can also dry it. A lot of what we have in our gardens can be air dried, particularly herbs and leafy crops. Air drying them is also a method that's been used for millennia.
Great. Thanks for the call, Don. We appreciate that. And that brings us to a couple of other things, something that's been around for a while, which is canning. And that's probably what most people think about when they think about preserving. Talk a little bit about canning. And is it easier than it used to be, or is it the same?
It's actually getting much easier. So canning is the basic process of taking a canning jar, mm-hmm. filling it with whatever you want to preserve, putting a lid on it, tightening that lid with a band, and then putting it into boiling water for a very specified amount of time. And so that basic process has been the same for 100 years, basically. One of the things that's getting easier is those lids have a special coating so that they seal to the jar. You used to have to warm up those lids in a separate pot of hot water and then put them on the jar. But now you don't even have to do that step. So, you know, I notice it because I do so much canning, but just that one step of not having to preheat the lids has made the whole process easier.
Wow, that's great. I remember my mom doing that and having that separate container with the rim, the lids and the, what are those called? The actual lids and then the things that you screw on top. So
Yeah, you screw the bands on.
The bands. Thank you very much. Yes. And that was, lovely to do in August when everything was so hot and whatnot. So, well, it's good to know it's a little bit easier. Do you need to have a pressure cooker?
You do not. In fact, the basic canning processing is just the boiling water and a period of time. And the time matters based on your altitude. So, for instance, I live at 7,000 feet elevation here in Colorado, and I have to add time to the processing. So when I'm doing my canning, depending on what it is I'm canning, I have to add an extra 15 to 20 minutes of that boiling. And so it's USDA tested, and you should be following a very specific recipe to make sure that the material is exposed to that heat for that amount of time. But that's it. It's just boiling water. And as mm-hmm. long as you've got a pot big enough for boiling water, that's good enough.
Okay.
Now, the key for regular canning is that we're talking about low pH, a high acid food. And so with a little addition of some lemon juice, we can do tomatoes. And there are a lot of other things that are naturally acidic that we don't need to do anything with. When we're talking about things like root vegetables that are not acidic at all, that's when we get into the pressure cooking or the pressure canning, because then it needs to be at a heat higher than the point of boiling to kill any fungal spores or anything that could cause that food to rot.
Okay.
And so that also is very altitude dependent to make sure that you get that high heat for the prescribed amount of time.
Mm-hmm. Do you still wait for the jars to ping?
Oh, yeah. In fact, for me, that ping happens as, so what you do, for those of you that don't know, is you have the hot jar in the boiling water and the time is over. You turn the flame off, wait a couple minutes, and then you lift it out with a jar lifter and set it on the counter. And as that lid seals, as the vacuum in the jar from that heat draws that lid down for a perfect seal, it pings. It does make an absolute sound. With my altitude and my temperature, sometimes as soon as I lift it out of the hot water, I get that ping.
Wow. Wow. I love it. And you can buy kits, can't you, with the whole, everything you need, including the recipes. My local library, you can actually check out the entire thing. So it's pretty accessible these days. So let's take a call from Mike in Madison. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi, guys. I'm so glad you mentioned high altitude time for that, because when I used to live in Colorado, my house was above 10,000 feet, beautiful Leadville, Colorado, and it took a lot of extra time to get all my canning done, but always well worth it. But I wanted to bring up what to do with two little tips. So people always ask me what to do with the giant zucchini that you went away for the weekend and you came back and now you've got this monster zucchini and what to do with it, and you can only make so much zucchini bread. But I like to make pickled zucchini, and you chop up those giant ones because they're nice and firm and they'll actually hold their texture. And you de-seed them and chop them into pickle spears and pickle them like you would a pickle, and they're phenomenal. And I give them out all the time. People are always amazed at the pickled zucchini. So options for your listeners. And the second thing, when you mentioned dehydrating fruits and vegetables, someone turned me on to this trick a few years back, and I've used it ever since, and it's great. Is before you dehydrate, especially the fruits, to get that sweetness and keep that sweetness, is spraying them with a little spritz of pineapple juice. And you spray them with a little spritz of pineapple juice and then put them in your dehydrator. And I use that for all my strawberries and a wide variety of fruits. And it just really brings out that extra sweetness and citrusy flavor. And it's not very difficult to do. And it's a great little trick. But I just thought I'd throw that out there. And your other call for tomatoes. Yes, I pickle lots of cherry tomatoes, get tons and tons of cherry tomatoes, and they're also great for pickling. And you can have little pickled cherry tomatoes to put on all your salads and Greek salads and all sorts of good stuff. But fantastic topic for a show today. I love it.
Oh, thanks, Mike. Appreciate that.
Mike.
Yeah, have you heard of that?
Those are good tips. I actually have pickled the zucchini. I completely agree with Mike. One of the things, if you haven't done it, Mike, is to ferment those same spears. So I have a video where I actually go through the process of fermenting the zucchini spears, because I was pickling them, and I actually like the flavor of fermented pickled zucchini spears. And it's incredibly easy to do and the spritz of pineapple. I like that idea. I will typically use a lemon juice, but I like the idea of the pineapple juice.
Mm-hmm. A little bit sweeter?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And when you ferment, you actually give a little bit more of a underlying sour taste to the pickling, right?
Yeah, it's so much, I think, more complex flavor. Basic pickling is a mixture of vinegar and water, and then depending on what you're trying to go for, some salt or some sugar or both. And then, like with pickling, you'll have some pickling spices in there. Where fermentation is just the salt or a brine made up of water and salt to like 3 to 4% salt. And as it ferments, the flavor will actually change over time. So I always recommend people that are just starting out with fermenting, the recipe may say that it's done in 4 to 7 days. Well, taste it at the 4-day point, and taste it at the 5-day point, and taste it at the 6-day point, and at the 7-day point. And you should notice a distinct difference in the flavor. And so, as you're asking, Jill, it depends on at what point you are finishing the ferment, which is usually by putting it into the refrigerator, and that slows down the bacteria so it's not fermenting anymore. But the depth of flavor and the spectrum of flavor based on how long you let it go is amazing.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, this area, of course, a lot of German settlers here, so there's a lot of sauerkraut made. Mm-hmm. And obviously, we know about that. Let's go to Terry in Rio. Go ahead, Terry.
Good morning. Very good show.
Thank you.
My wife and I have been big canners for a lot of years and always did water baths. But 2 years ago, we switched to steam canning, which you only have to heat up about 2 or 2.5 inches of water in the bottom of a steam canner. The USDA timing for steam canning is exactly the same as hot water bath. And it's much quicker. You don't have to reheat all that water up. A couple inches of water heats up very quickly, and it saves a lot of time. It does the same thing. Thank you. Very good.
Thanks, Terry.
That's an excellent tip. I've done a little bit of steam canning, but it does require like a base because you've got to have the jar setting above the water that's boiling. And so, I've had my same water bath canner for over 20 years now, and I'm not quite ready to trade everything in. But yes, it's a very easy, very effective way of doing the same thing, and because it's that temperature, the boiling temperature, and so the steam is giving that same temperature for the canning of whatever it is you want to seal.
There you go. Well, Terry, thank you so much for sharing that with us. We appreciate it. Always get great information from our guests as well as our listeners. So we appreciate that. We are talking about preserving, but of course, we can take any of your gardening questions. Our guest today is Scott Wilson, better known as YouTube's Gardener Scott. So if you've got a question about preserving or if you want to share with us some of the ways that you like to preserve your garden harvest, please give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email, and that's talk@wpr.org. And we can also take some of your gardening questions, whatever happens to be on your mind. I have a feeling, Scott, that a lot of our listeners are out in the garden right now because it's so beautiful out. And I probably will be out there as soon as I get home today, too, because it is gorgeous. So again, if you want to have a question for us, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or like I said, email talk@wpr.org. And we'll be back after a little tiny break, so stay with us. This is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Next week on the show, it's time to talk about lawns with sod specialist Doug Soldat. And then we'll also hear about the beautiful Anderson Japanese gardens that are just over the border in Rockford. I visited them last weekend and I was so impressed. I'm pretty much in love. You know, I want to tear everything out and make a Japanese garden. But anyway, you'll hear all about them. Right now, we're talking about preserving and answering your gardening questions. So if you have any, give us a call, 800-642-1234. Let's go right to the phones. John in Sun Prairie, go right ahead.
Hi, this is John. I just wanted to mention another great recipe for giant zucchinis that are too prevalent these days. A friend of mine just showed me just grating up the zucchini with a coarse grater, adding a little bit of citric acid to keep the color better and maybe a little bit of salt, and just canning them in quart jars. And I do pressure canning for those. And then all winter I have a quart of shredded zucchini that can be used for a zucchini pie, kind of like a quiche, or a zucchini bread. So it's really handy way to have zucchini all winter. The other thing is, I was going to mention steam canning, but somebody beat me to it. What a great thing. I mostly do pressure canning, but with some of the acid foods, I now do steam canning. And my pressure canner without the jiggler on, it works great for the steam canning. And it's so much quicker than water baths. So I really appreciate the lack of having to heat up all that water.
Okay, thanks, John. What do you think, Scott? You're going to start thinking about more steam canning?
Yeah, I might get into that. do need to say that with water bath canning methods with something like zucchini, you really do have to be careful because the pH really does need to be lower than 4.6 for it to be shelf stable. But canning and putting it in the refrigerator or putting it into the freezer is definitely an option. Now, John said that he pressure cans. So pressure canning zucchini is what allows it to stay at room temperature and to be shelf stable. But I did something similar with freezing, where I have a recipe that I love for zucchini bread that calls for 3 cups of zucchini. And so I would shred 3 cups of zucchini and do the same thing. We'd put it into jars for later bread making, but typically I would put it into the freezer.
John, you just read my mind because I was going to say the exact same thing. I put it in the exact amount that I need for zucchini bread and freeze it. And that was going to lead to freezing because that is a great way, especially if you have room, to preserve your harvest. So let's talk about freezing a little bit. Do you blanch or not blanch? Because I've heard both sides.
So it depends. The reason, primary reason for blanching is that a lot of what we're harvesting still has active enzymes. And so those enzymes are what cause the color change. So when we talk about oxidizers, or we're looking for something that is an antioxidant, it's all because of the enzymes that are present. And when we blanch it, we are stopping the enzymes from changing the color or changing the flavor. So for most of the things that I am going to freeze, I do blanch just to stop that color change or taste change because of the enzymes.
Okay, and how long?
And so a lot of it depends. For smaller items, it's only 30 to 45 seconds. There's a few things, depending on the recipe that you're using, that might call for a minute or a minute and a half. But it really, you don't want to cook it. And that's the key difference is It only takes a few seconds at that hot temperature to stop the enzyme action. And so between 30 seconds and a minute is usually enough for almost everything that we're going to be freezing.
And what can't be blanched?
Well, and so you have to anticipate the fact that you're talking about hot water, and that's what you're doing. You're taking the fruit or vegetable, putting into simmering water. It doesn't need to be full boiling for a period of time, 30, 45 seconds. Then you're taking it out and putting it into ice water to to stop the effect of that heat. And so something that is cooked very quickly, like spinach, for instance, is not going to do well blanched. And so freezing spinach raw also doesn't work as well, which is why most people will cook spinach ahead of time and then freeze it. But it's those type of things. It's those lighter vegetables that are susceptible to being cooked in 30 seconds that the blanching just won't work.
Okay. But can we cook things before we put them in the freezer too, right?
Yeah. And that is one of, you know, I think a lot of people are preserving without actually realizing that they're preserving when they take their garden fresh produce and they make some dish and then they freeze that dish, or, you know, like zucchini bread.
Right.
I would make 2 loaves of zucchini bread and I would put 1 in the freezer. That is essentially preserving the zucchini and using freezing as the method.
What's your opinion on corn on the cob?
I love it.
Okay. And do you freeze it?
And so corn on the cob is an example of one that should be blanched. And it's, you know, about 45 seconds or so. And then freezing it. And I freeze it on the cob because I love corn on the cob. And then when you pull it out, you don't even need to thaw it. You just put it into your pot of water and bring it up to boiling, and then it's ready to go. And so as we talk about, one of the reasons I love preserving is you can do so many things with the garden produce. It doesn't just have to be you're preserving corn. You can make an herb butter or a compound butter using the herbs from your garden. And so just last week, I made a compound butter using thyme and basil from my garden, mixing it with butter. And the reason I bring that up, because it tastes incredible on corn on the cob.
Oh, yes. Yes, that sounds great. And a little tomato powder?
Tomato or garlic powder.
There you go. There you go. It sounds great. Well, I think the only thing we haven't really covered is refrigerator pickling. A lot of people do that. Refrigerator pickles in particular, extremely popular. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so almost anything can be pickled, and refrigerator pickles is so easy. The basic recipe is 1-to-1 vinegar to water, and then you decide what additional component for the flavor. Do you want it sweet? You add some sugar. Add a little bit of salt to give it a little bit of tang. And then the spices. I almost always will add in a little garlic with whatever type of refrigerator pickle I want. But the ones that I do most often are radishes and onions. You slice up a purple onion and you put it into that vinegar and water and garlic and salt and pepper and maybe a little red pepper from the garden because you powdered it and you're all ready to go. And then after a couple of hours, you've got delicious pickled onions. And you can do the same thing with radishes. Beets make a really nice, crunchy refrigerator pickle if you like beets. They need to be in that pickling solution for a longer period of time to really get the flavor. But it's easy. It's just cut up, put in the pickling solution, put it in your refrigerator for a couple hours or overnight, and you've got pickles.
It's astonishing to me how quickly they can soak up that flavor.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really doesn't take long.
No, not at all. Speaking of garlic, Lori in Eau Claire called to ask about black garlic, and she wonders if black garlic has enhanced or diminished medicinal qualities and if its complex flavor is worth the trouble to produce.
And so that's actually my next preservation. I bought a rice cooker, and I'm planning next week to start making black garlic. It is a very lengthy process, 6 weeks, and it has to be at a steady temperature of around 140 degrees for that entire 6-week process.
Oh, my gosh.
So it is a very time-consuming method of preserving. But from what I'm reading, there haven't been any that I found, any U.S. studies, but there have been some studies and test cases in other countries that do prescribe some medicinal aspects to it. And that is debatable. Really, the reason to do it is the flavor. It really takes garlic to a completely new dimension. It doesn't taste like garlic. The texture is different. The color is different. But the flavor is more of a umami, earthy flavor than the garlic flavor that we're used to.
That sounds amazing. I don't think I've ever heard of it before. So you basically are just keeping it at a high temperature for all this time.
Yeah, and it's not dehydrating because it needs to be in a sealed environment. So you actually have it completely wrapped. So all of the moisture within the garlic stays within the garlic for this entire time. And so that's why the consistency is completely different, because it's not a dried garlic and it's not a dehydrated garlic. It essentially becomes this completely different texture because that moisture and that heat completely changed the cellular structure.
Wow, amazing. Our guest today is Scott Wilson, better known as YouTube's Gardener Scott. What questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And Grant did just that to say that his favorite way of preserving tomatoes is to make tomato puree. He uses it to make tomato bread, where the liquid in the dough is 100% puree. He likes to use heirloom tomatoes that he blanches, peels, and then oven roasts to concentrate the flavors. The final step is to puree until perfectly smooth, and after it is cooled, he puts the puree into 1-quart freezer bags and freezes them immediately. Have you done that?
Great idea.
Yeah.
I have, slightly differently, but yes, absolutely. And that is the key. Is we talked about blanching. He's right. Tomatoes are one of those that you blanch. The thing about blanching tomatoes, most of the freezing methods or freezing recipes will have you peel the skin off the tomato first. And so if you do a cross cut at the base of a tomato and then put it into blanch, when you pull it out, the skin peels right off. And then you can either freeze it whole, freeze it in halves, do the juicing. You can do the puree like he talks about. Tomatoes are just so versatile in the prep. And then you put them into a bag pre-measured, like we were talking about for the zucchini, if you have a specific recipe, and you just take it out when you want to use it.
Perfect. Jody in Brooklyn has a comment about tomatoes. Go ahead, Jody.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My comment with the tomatoes, and this was born from wanting a BLT in January and February, I make tomato jam, which is common, but I make it more savory, and I do it on the stovetop, and I do it with my small tomatoes, and I add whatever I feel like at the moment. Sometimes I add basil. Always garlic and onions, and sometimes I blend it up finer. Sometimes I leave it a little chunky and put it in the freezer. And then I do have a question. I've never been happy with my frozen green beans. Any tips for me?
And so green beans, Jody, and by the way, those tomatoes sound incredible. I'm going to have to try to make some of that soon. But green beans are one of those plants that need to be blanched. And so that can make the difference. They will freeze much better if you blanch them before you freeze them. And I did some green beans a month or so ago, and I was also not happy with what happened. And it turns out I harvested them too late. So the harvest time, that's what we had talked about in the very beginning of the show, was making sure you are doing the preserving right at the perfect point. And in my case, I had just waited too long to harvest, and then blanched and then froze. And then when I got them out to use, they were tough and they weren't as good. So the timing is important and the blanching is important.
Okay, so maybe, would it be a good idea for her to maybe experiment? So she does some earlier ones and then some little bit later and a little bit later?
Yeah, yeah. I was just talking about that with the gardener a couple of days ago to determine that with, you know, squashes are a good example of trying to decide when is the best time. And so you'll see recommendations, for instance, on like a yellow squash or a small zucchini that you want to harvest when they're 6 to 8 inches. And so harvest at 6 inches and eat it. Harvest at 8 inches and eat it. Harvest at 10 inches and eat it. And wait till it becomes a monster and then eat it. And you'll be able to note the difference along the way. And it's the same with green beans. Eat them when they're still young and earlier than you might normally think. And you might be surprised at how sweet and tasty a young bean or pea is.
Yes. Okay. Well, good luck, Jody. Appreciate your call. Kate in Appleton called but couldn't stay with us, and she wanted to know if you have made tomato jam or jelly, and if you so, can you share a recipe?
So I'm so glad that you asked us. That was one area that I love and that we hadn't talked about was making jams and jellies.
Yeah.
And I've made jams. I've made, and also I want to throw in as well, the idea of cooking or scorching or roasting ahead of time before you make a jam, that like Jody was talking about, getting that savory aspect really does make a difference. And so I've made tomato jam, I've made roasted pepper jam, and that I grow it, I've made a jam or a jelly about it, but I always follow an approved recipe. So I go to the Ball Blue Book or the Ball Complete Guide to Home Preservation, the Kerr books. These are the same companies that are making the jars, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
They have books that have all of these different recipes. And if you go to the USDA site for preservation, they also have recipes. And so I don't want to give a recipe off the top of my head because I'm always using a recipe from an approved source for all of the different things that I'm trying.
For sure. And speaking of, I was kind of intrigued. You make hot sauce. And I think that's one use of tomatoes that we haven't touched on yet. Tell us a little bit about making hot sauce.
And so when I make a hot sauce, there are two basic methods, like with a pepper hot sauce. There's the Louisiana method, which is primarily vinegar-based. And so it's essentially pickling the pepper. And then you put it in a food processor or a blender to grind it up into a sauce. Or there's a fermented method, which is the same thing as we've been talking about, using a salt brine. You ferment, then you grind it up into a sauce. And if you want to keep itself shelf stable, that's where the pH, again, it needs to be below 4.6 pH. That's why vinegar is often a method that is being used. But fermenting lowers the pH to around 4.0, 3.8 in many cases. And then it becomes shelf stable and you can just have it on your counter and use it whenever you want.
Do you have a favorite pepper that you like to use or do you like to combine?
So cayenne peppers are my favorite peppers. But when I make a hot sauce, I will blend up a couple different types. And so Jimmy Nardello is one of my favorite sweet peppers, and I will pickle slices of the Jimmy Nardello to put on like brats or burgers. But the addition of a Jimmy Nardello with cayenne and then grinding it all together or blending it together to make a flavor is just really wonderful because both peppers have different flavors and different amounts of heat, and the sweet pepper tends to bring the heat down a little bit so that more people can enjoy it.
Oh, that's a good idea. I like that. And one thing that we did not talk about yet also is the fact that there are some things that you can just store if you put it in the right conditions. So talk a little bit about what we can store over the winter and what those conditions have to be.
And so roots cellars have been around the Midwest of the U.S. for centuries, and the idea is to take the fruit, typically, or root, and put it into a cool condition so that bacterial action slows down. It is important to choose the right fruit or root to use. So winter squashes, for instance, are different than summer squashes. And it's because the summer squashes are meant to be eaten right away, whereas winter squashes have a thicker skin. They often have less moisture, and they can be stored for months. Generally, it should be below 50 degrees to have that nice storage. But you can just put it into a cool, dark closet if you've got extra space. And if it's the right crop, beets will store very well at lower temperatures, and parsnips and turnips, and then, of course, lots of other winter squashes are just ideal for putting into storage. And, of course, classic are onions and potatoes that they'll store for months if you put them into cooler conditions.
What about carrots? We had a root cellar, and whenever anyone says the word root cellar, I can smell what that root cellar smelled like. But we used to store carrots in sand. They would eventually start to sprout, but have you done that before?
Yeah, and so that's the hardest thing, particularly with carrots, because they tend to be less dense or thinner than those other roots, is if you just let them sit in the air, they're going to dry out, they're going to shrivel. And so by putting them in sand or wrapping them in newspaper and then lining them in a box, you're helping to retain some of that moisture. And that really is the approach that you want to take for some of those lighter root vegetables to last longer.
Is there a certain amount of humidity that we should be shooting for when we're trying to store things like that?
Yeah, depending on what it is, and you'll see different numbers about the humidity, because generally it should be a cool, dark, dry location so that it doesn't rot. Mm-hmm. And that's difficult for a lot of regions to actually get that dryness, but you don't want a high humidity. The humidity will lead to the moisture in the fruit or vegetable or fruit and a root, and that can lead to it changing texture and not necessarily rotting quickly, but you're going to lose that dense flavor and texture that you want generally in a long-term storage. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, Scott, thank you so much for sharing all of your expertise with us today about preserving and some of the other things that got thrown in between. We really appreciate it. How can people find all of your videos?
So I'm Gardener Scott, and I'm Gardener Scott at YouTube, and I'm Gardener Scott at Instagram. And I've got a number of preservation videos, as you know, that you discovered, but mostly gardening on my YouTube channel.
Mm-hmm. There are lots of them. So if you are looking for any advice other than garden talk, of course, then you should check it out. So thank you again, Scott. And I hope the weather starts turning fall where you are.
Thanks, Jill. It's a pleasure to be here.
We'll talk to you soon. Thanks. And thank you for listening. We really appreciate it. And just a reminder that next week at this time, we're going to have Doug Soldat back with us. He's a sod specialist here at UW-Madison. So we'll be talking about lawns. And then in the last half hour, we have one of the people from the Anderson Japanese Gardens with us to talk about that. We want to thank our technical director, Jeff Robbins, for doing a great job once again, and for our screener today, our call screener, Joel Patinot, and for listening to the show. We really appreciate it. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you again next time.